It's high noon in Vancouver, and welcome to the local Brown Bagger Show, right here on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. No doubt you have heard the news. The Arctic Sea has melted to record low levels. With a decent satellite mapping system, it is now possible to sail your boat through the fabled Northwest Channel right across the top of Canada. So much ice has peeled away from both Canada and Russia, a new rash of claims and flags are staking out the Arctic. Meanwhile, the ancient people of the North, the Inuit, have watched their lives and ecosystems disappear. Today, we'll hear from Inuit activist Sheila Watt-Cloutier. Her topic is The Right to be Cold, Climate Change, and Human Rights.
I'm foreseeing results. The point of no return.
When I go around the world and we see that there is just no connection to what is it that we do in our homes, what is it we do in our communities and cities far away from what is happening in the Arctic, that I realize that it is so important for us to continue to start really thinking in terms of connectivity and the interconnectedness of all of us in this world. And so the disconnects are just everywhere. There are layers and layers of it. And if we can use the Arctic as a place that connects us as to what's happening up there, I think it's very important.
That's Sheila Watt-Cloutier, and this is the second season of Canadian Voices, a nationally syndicated public affairs radio series and podcast featuring lectures by thought-provoking Canadians, produced by Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia, and aired on campus and community radio stations across the country. For details and background on the series, as well as access to our program archive, we're online at canadianvoices.org. I'm Zoe Creighton. This edition of Canadian Voices features Sheila Watt-Cloutier, climate change activist, outgoing chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and nominee for the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. She speaks on the right to be cold, the Arctic environment, climate change, and human rights. Sheila Watt-Cloutier has made it her life's work to preserve the environment and advocate for the people of the circumpolar region. In many of her speeches, she borrows the words of the Honorable Julian Hunte, ambassador and permanent representative of St. Lucia to the United Nations, who remarks, "The adverse impacts of climate change are real, immediate, and devastating." Watt-Cloutier argues that for the 155,000 residents of the circumpolar region, climate change has become a human rights issue as its impacts are destroying communities' rights to life, culture, health, property, and means of subsistence. For Inuit, sea ice allows for safe travel on the perilous Arctic waters and provides a stable platform from which to hunt. The ice forms not only the roads, but also, Watt-Cloutier contends, the Inuit's supermarket. Deteriorating ice conditions imperil Inuit in many ways, ranging from thinning ice creating safety issues for hunters, much shorter hunting seasons, and the demise of some ice-dependent species such as ringed seals, walrus, and polar bears, which, according to the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, will likely be pushed to extinction by the end of this century. A study championed by the organization that Watt-Cloutier represented for many years, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, or ICC, showed in 2004 that average annual temperatures are increasing more than twice as fast in the Arctic as in the rest of the world. Watt-Cloutier maintains that the Inuit, on a daily basis, observe the minute changes that are occurring in the environment. "We are the guardians of the environment," she explains, "because we're on the land every day. We're the early warning system for the rest of the world." In December 2006, Watt-Cloutier was named a nation builder in the Globe and Mail's year-end roundup of people or groups who have made a significant contribution to Canadian society. She was recognized for her worldwide campaign to publicize these threats that greenhouse gases pose to the Inuit way of life. In June of the same year, the Canadian Environment Awards honored Watt-Cloutier with the Citation of Lifetime Achievement for her climate change work. Later that year, she was also named to the Order of Canada. She spoke on March 7, 2006, at the Wilderness Institute at University of Montana's Wilderness Lecture Series in Missoula, Montana.
Nakulmik, Nakulmik, meaning thank you in my language. Thank you for having me here. I've come from pretty far away to travel down here. I was in Salt Lake City actually speaking as well before here. And making those connections are very, very important to me, in particularly in the United States, if you can well appreciate that. But we have a wonderful history with Americans where I come from. During the time, just around the wartime, when we were going through enormous struggles and challenges and starvation, in fact, when our own governments almost had forgotten us way up there in the Arctic, the Americans arrived with jobs and making runways in my hometown long before I was born, and saved the day. And up until my mother died 3 years ago, she said, you know, we never would have made it if it weren't for the Americans when they arrived. So we have a real soft spot in our hearts for all Americans. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as I end my talk tonight. Yes, I represent 155,000 Inuit in the entire world. We're not so many, but I always say we're still 155,000 strong. And I know that this lecture series itself is called the Wilderness Lecture Series, but I will say that the word wilderness itself for us is not a concept that translates very well, and I'm sure you can appreciate that, and I don't say this in any negating terms at all, but just because we are so connected to everything out there that it's our homeland, it's not wilderness, and that it is very rich and bountiful homeland that we live in. And we don't see our environment as wild per se, you know, so and separate from us at all. But nevertheless, we understand that this is how it is sometimes. And we are a people of the land. We really are a people of the snow, the ice, and we thrive on it. Everything up there is about the land itself and what it gives to us. We connect to everything around us, the ecosystems and so on. And so the converse, though, of the concept of wild, of course, is of the wild environment separate from the day-to-day life of people is one of connectivity. And that's really what I talk about a lot when I go around the world to talk about these issues. And I think one of the most important messages that I like to be able to give to people when I talk is that we're all connected and that this planet and its people are one. And although I am far from the Arctic and the issues up there, that we are very challenged by them, everything that happens in the south is connected to what is happening and the challenges that we face in the Arctic. And I always say that the cars that we drive, the industries that we support, the disposable world that we have become is very much connected to the Inuit hunters that are falling through the ice. And we have to continue to keep that kind of understanding for all of us to be able to do something together. And in fact, the Arctic has become known to be the health barometer for the planet now. And in fact, a few years ago, the United Nations Environment Program Governing Council indicated that the Arctic is now known as the health indicator and that more focus should be brought to the attention of the world as to what's happening. And in fact, we've become the canary in the coal mine. It's happening fastest in the Arctic, these changes. And again, we are indeed the early warning. A little late for us, but yet early for the rest of the world, because I will now get into some of the very stark realities of what is happening up in the Arctic. For more than 20 years now, our hunters and our elders have been observing many, many changes. We have the melting of the permafrost. We have ice that is forming much later in the fall, leaving much earlier in the spring. We have receding glaciers. We have more and more insects and different species of animals and fish and birds that are coming up into the Arctic now. Things that we don't even have names for because they're just so new and foreign to us. The magnitude of these changes, they may vary place to place, but the trend is certainly consistent throughout the Arctic, whether it be Alaska, Canada, Russia, or Greenland. In the circumpolar world, it's all happening. And in fact, some of the major changes that are happening most in Alaska, in the USA. Now, just to give you a real recent picture of what's happened, along with what happened last summer in one of our communities, we work in Celsius up in Canada now, and we were at 37 degrees Celsius one time in one of our communities last summer, where some of our elders were trying to stay cool with wetted sheets because we don't have air conditioning, we don't have, you know, we weren't prepared for those kinds of temperatures in some of our communities, and that's pretty alarming. And just more recently, though, on the 26th of February, which is just very recent, and that was my daughter's 30th birthday, so I won't forget that day, pouring rain in Iqaluit, where I live, pouring rain to the point where I woke up in the morning and there were pools and puddles of water that was not freezing in my backyard, which is the tundra, because it was just too warm. It was 6 degrees, which is 47 Fahrenheit. This is the Arctic in February, at the end of February. And so this is something that we understand that weather is variable. That is a given, but this is way beyond our experience, just way beyond. And so when that happens, it is affecting every facet of the life of our hunting culture. As I say, our hunting culture is based on the cold, on the ice and the snow. And we travel on the ice and the snow most of the year. And it is our transportation. You go to the supermarkets to get your food. We go to the environment to get our food. And so we have to travel on the ice and the snow during the winter to do that. And so we want to maintain that cold. And in fact, I've always said, and as you can see, the title of my talk is called The Right to be Cold. We're fighting for our right to be cold. And at first glance, I think when people first hear that, they say, well, who on earth wants to be cold? Well, when you look a little bit deeper at this, well, we on Earth in the Arctic, whose culture is based on the cold and the snow and the ice, want to remain that way because it's a vibrant, incredible, resilient, wise culture. But resilience has its limitations now, and we are really starting to get to that threshold where the challenges are very great. So we have actual accidents that are happening that are life and death issues, as we have people literally losing their lives as a result of this. I have a neighbor who lives across the street from me in Iqaluit a few years ago, a very seasoned hunter in his late 60s, a revered hunter, in fact, who has known the conditions and is very well known to be a great hunter, fell through the ice because he wasn't able to predict or see the actual conditions of the ice now. And that's what happens, is that even our elders and revered hunters who know the situation have a tougher time reading the actual conditions of the ice because the conditions no longer are the same underneath what you can't see. And there's more and more accidents and more drownings and more of these kinds of things that are happening. And Simon, as a result, because it took time for people to find him, he was traveling alone, lost both his legs as a result of that. We have glaciers that are melting so very quickly in certain parts of the Arctic that where there used to be streams and hunters were, for generations, have been taught to cross these streams to get to the other side and of certain hunting grounds and so on, thinking that they could still do that. But because the glaciers are melting so very quickly, they've become torrent rivers. And we've had drowning as a result of that as well. So these kinds of life and death situations are happening for us in the Arctic. And what we have been witnessing for the past 15 years or so is certainly something that is now being correlated with the recent studies that have been done. And the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which involved 300 scientists from 15 countries, and many of those scientists from the United States. In fact, the chair of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment is Bob Correll, who is American, an incredible scientist who is probably the best science communicator I know. And he and I talk around the world at certain venues now, and we call it the Bob and Sheila Roadshow as we go around talking. He does the science and I do the human impacts. And the secretariat was in Fairbanks, Alaska, so definitely, and most of the money came from the United States of America. So when that assessment came out, it took about 4 years to put together. And it involved not only Western science, but we incorporated traditional knowledge, which is science in itself. And I've always said that our hunters are scientists in their own right. They may not have the institutional recognition as such, but they definitely are scientists. I mean, if you can build a house of snow warm enough for your babies to sleep in naked and have the Hayak be the most incredibly engineered boat, renownedly recognized all over the world, I believe you me, you're a pretty good scientist and architect. So after 4 years of this work that was done, under the auspices and the umbrella of the Arctic Council, the assessment came out in November 2004, and it really shocked the world because it was stark reading. It was something that we could see coming because it was something that our hunters had been witnessing now for the past 10 or 15 years. And so it was not so much as a shock to us, but to the world it was, because there's a real void in the world when it comes to science of climate change. And the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment is the most comprehensive, detailed assessment to date of climate change, and it happens to be on the circumpolar world. And so it was very, very stark reading. And it not only, featured, the melting of glaciers and the polar bears and the summer sea ice that was disappearing, but basically it says three things. It says that climate change is happening in the Arctic now, it is quickly going to get worse, and climate change in the Arctic is globally important. And the ICIA also gives examples and case illustrations of traditional knowledge. As I said, it's woven into as many chapters as we could. And we played a key role in that because we really wanted not to be just researched and studied, but we needed to be part of that process from day one. And that was very important for us as indigenous peoples of the Arctic. And it wasn't just Inuit who were involved. There were Athabascans and the Gwich'in and the Dene and the Sami people of the Sami land, and also the Rikon indigenous peoples of northern Russia, including our own fellow Inuit as well. And I want to read to you two conclusions of that Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, and when I do read them, please do try to remember that we are an ancient people connected to a hunting culture that is based on the sea and the ice. The first one states, and there are several highlights, of course, and summaries, but these are the two that really count for us. Marine species dependent on sea ice, including polar bears, ice-living seals, walrus, and some marine birds, are very likely to decline, with some species facing extinction. And for Inuit, warming is likely to disrupt or even destroy their hunting and food-sharing culture, as reduced sea ice causes the animals on which they depend to decline, become less accessible, and possibly become extinct.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to Sheila Watt-Cloutier, Inuit activist, on The Right to be Cold, Climate Change, and Human Rights.
Scientists, as we know them, are cautious people, and rightly so. But, you know, when they were working on this, they didn't pull any punches in the ACIA, and that's because they're very confident in their findings and the projections that are there. They're very confident in that. And as I say, it really does correlate with what we have been observing, so we know that this is for real. And following that, though, following the scientific reports that followed that are telling us that, in fact, that the projections are conservative. They're moderate. So you can imagine what could possibly happen in the Arctic and how that becomes that early warning for the rest of the world. And because it's happening faster than they even projected just a few years ago, even when this work started 4 years ago, things are happening much quicker than we ever thought would happen. The Greenland ice sheet is melting 50 times more. I mean, it's just phenomenal what's happening up there. And as a result of that, of course, everything connects. The Greenland ice sheet melts, the low-lying developing states sink. And we are making those kinds of connections now with the other countries of the world that are vulnerable, as we are in the Arctic. And that's very important. But we as Inuit are very adaptable, and we're very resourceful. We've had to be. I mean, imagine living in the Arctic. I mean, lots of people, of course, figure, oh, you know, it's such a harsh and foreboding land and all the rest of it. But, you know, for us, it's home. It's homeland, and we've got everything around us that we could possibly want, and we want to keep it that way. And we are an adaptable people. All throughout our generations, we have traveled following the seasons and the wildlife. The first 10 years of my life, I traveled only by dog team. My family, we were just a small family, and we hunted and fished, and I was the baby, so I was in the hamotik, what we call the sled in the back, you know, in the box, actually, because I was the little one. And traveled only by dog team the first 10 years of my life. And to think the changes that have happened in my lifetime, I feel as though sometimes I've lived three lifetimes in the 52 years, because most societies have taken about 350 years to adapt and adjust. And for us, in one lifetime at 52, this is the life in which we have come. And now I fly, you know, jumbo jets to Geneva or New York, South Africa, to help negotiate UN treaties, just to give you that window of that the speed in which our lives have changed in the Arctic and in our world. And so we are, we have had to be very adaptable, of course. But you know, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment now foresees a time when, in the lifetime of my own grandson, where environmental changes are going to be so great that we won't be able to keep up with the dramatic changes. And already we're trying now to adjust and adapt to the first wave that came, because as I say, in my lifetime, we've come from such a traditional way of life to what we live today. And as a result of that rapid change, there are this sense that happened in just in my lifetime alone, and have been witness to it, have been through it, is the real breaking down of the fabric of our society at the Inuit community and family level. And we are known to have the highest suicide rates in North America, especially with our young men. And so these are very real issues that we're dealing with. And as we're coming out the other side of this first wave and realizing that the answers and solutions lie in the wisdom of our culture, we realize we're being poisoned from afar, because we, the Inuit, because we're marine mammal eaters, become the net recipients of persistent organic pollutants that end up in our bodies and in the nursing milk of our mothers. And so we have higher levels than anywhere in southern Canada and southern places, than anywhere else, 7 to 10 times higher in the nursing milk of our mothers. And then now we realize, as we're coming out the other side once again, there is no place in the world, by the way, where it's just so parallel, a POPs issue and the climate change issue, as it is in the Arctic, because it's an issue of cultural heritage and survival and health for us. And so these issues are very much paralleled. And so when you think of these struggles, and you know that, you know, we might have just that 10 to 15 year window to really make effective changes to what's happening in the Arctic, and that we could perhaps forestall and slow down the process of what could happen to the rest of the world, and how much harder it's going to be in the Arctic, we feel compelled to do all we can to keep telling this story and making people understand and helping people to understand that the world is one and the people are one. And so I would ask you this, and I ask this every time I speak, that how would you respond if that kind of international assessment with, you know, from 300 scientists and from 15 countries concluded that your age-old culture and economy was doomed, and that you were probably going to become a footnote in the history of globalization? And what can we do as Inuit to really be effective and to help governments take that required steps to address these issues of mitigation, of lowering of the greenhouse gases, and of adaptation? And how can we in the Arctic help the states to develop the global perspective that we all need on this issue that is so important? And I attend many, many forums around the world. I have speaking engagements, but I'm also heavily engaged in, as chair of Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and even before that when I was the president of ICC Canada and headed the debate on our issues of POTS at the global level. These conferences sometimes are so difficult because the issue, especially of climate change, is one that has become all about technology, all about the politics of things, all about, you know, the economies, which are very, very important, but people have forgotten that this is a people issue, that it isn't just about trading of carbon sinks and emissions trading and so on, which you often see at these very highly technical meetings, such as the Conference of the Parties under the United Nations framework on climate change. And so the bigger picture, which is so very important, the cultural picture, the human picture, is often very lost in these huge venues. And in Montreal, there were 10,000 delegates that were there. You know, how do you make your mark? And it's not, you know, this issue of climate change isn't just about bureaucrats that are scurrying around, running around, trying to find the, you know, the fine-tuning of the language of these global conventions that really just don't have that sense of that heartbeat to it, the soul and the human face to these issues, because really these issues are about family, they're about community, they're about our children and what it is that we're trying to do to make it a better world for all of our children, not just my grandson, but everybody's grandchildren. And because we're Inuit who understand the connections between all of these things, and I'm not suggesting that others don't, but because we're still very much a hunting, fishing, gathering people, we are still in the rhythms of nature, the ecosystems and the cycles of all of what is around us. We're out there every single day. And in my home, my view is the Frobisher Bay. And every day our hunters are going out there on the ice and coming home. Every day I witness that in the winter on the ice. In the summer, it's the boats that are going in and out all the time. My grandson now hunts with his father. My grandson will be 9 in July. And so because we understand all of these connections, that we find that the importance of a hunting culture is one that we are really relying upon to help us cope and really start to take back some of that control in our lives, because the hunting culture is extremely, I think, misunderstood in the world. And often people just think, well, you know, why do people want to kill animals and keep living that way? Well, it's not just about killing of animals. This is life-giving life, and that's how we understand it as Indigenous peoples. And also, the process and the power of the hunt is just remarkable place for young people to learn about life, not just the technical skills of hunting, of aiming the gun and skinning the seal and cutting up the meat and so on. It's about building the character that is required to survive not only on the land, but they're very transferable in the modern world. And the examples that I always give is that we are teaching our young people out on the land how to be bold under pressure, how to withstand stress, how to be courageous, how to be patient, how to have sound judgment and ultimately wisdom. These are the skills that one requires to make the proper choices in life, to embrace life, to say no to addictions, to say no to suicide, to have that strength from within so that they can embrace their lives and not take it. Because we're in that place today as Inuit people, where we are really challenged as to how do we deal with our young people and how do we prepare them. My grandson is growing up in the love and safety of his parents' home and mine, but he is under all of what is happening in that cultural transition that we're in, the influences that are out there. And I want him to be able to still have the power and the wisdom of that land and what are the teachings of that, so that when things are hard for him in teenage life and his later years as a young man, he will be able to be there and have something to hold on to and embrace his life. He is named after his auntie who took her own life, even though she was a girl. We named him one of his names after her. This is the reality of where this little boy will grow up in. So this is about children. This is about people. And so it's very important for us, as we're coming out the other side of these challenges, that we see this in terms of human terms, and that the Inuit culture and the ecosystem of the Arctic is absolutely important for the rest of this planet. There is a reason why we are all here in different places in the world. There is a purpose to all of that. And if you can keep us on the land in the Arctic, we not only will protect it for ourselves, but for the planet. We're that early warning. We're that sentinel ecosystem, and we're that sentinel. We're that guard. Keep us on the land, and we will be able to tell the world and continue to tell the world what is happening. And so we try to encourage others to think in those terms of how we're all so connected. And so we, you know, having the incredible challenges that we have been having over the course of the last few years about how to put ourselves on the map and how do we work with governments around the world. Yes, we have come far in terms of addressing these issues. Yes, we've got the assessment now, the science to back what we've been saying for years. And yes, there are ways in which we're making our mark. But you know, we have a big challenge on our hands. We have the United States of America that is not signing on to the Kyoto Protocol, a powerful nation that has such potential to change the course of this debate more than anyone else. It emits 25% of greenhouse gases in the entire world. It is a big emitter. We have been trying very hard through the ACIA to make sure that the United States was a player in all of this, a global player. We've had challenges, which I won't get into now, as to how can we get the United States on board? How can we do this? But because it continues to be such an incredible challenge, and because we see the urgency and the immediacy at a people, community, children level, we have decided to take the route of making this a human rights issue. Over 3 years ago, we started to prepare and find what kinds of instruments exist out there in the world that are there to protect us in the world. And we have decided that there is such instruments out there, and because in Canada and in Alaska, we Inuit fall under the Organization of American States, we have chosen to use the instrument of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is Washington-based, to launch a petition.
You're listening to Canadian Voices, a nationally syndicated public affairs radio series and podcast featuring lectures by thought-provoking Canadians. Produced by Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia, and online at canadianvoices.org. This edition features Sheila Watt-Cloutier speaking in Missoula, Montana, in March 2006.
So having worked in preparation, it took us over 2 years to work on this. It's not a lawsuit. We're not suing for damages or money. We didn't want that even to be part of the debate where it could be dismissed and say, oh, these people just want money, because it isn't about that. So myself and 62 hunters filed a petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on December the 7th, of just before Christmas of 2005, on behalf of Canadian and Alaskan Inuit. And our petition asks the commission to come north to the Arctic to find out what is happening to our environment in the Arctic. And also, we seek a declaration. At the end of the day, once the commission has come north, we hope, and had hearings and so on, what we're seeking is a declaration. A declaration that indeed would detail that this is in fact a violation of the human rights of the Inuit of the Arctic, as detailed in the 1948 Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. And a declaration from the Commission may not be enforceable, per se, because it's not legal on legal ground, although it's a very strong legal assertion, legal document. It does have great moral and political value. And I think we really need this high moral ground if we're to persuade and encourage not only the United States and government, but governments around the world and the industries around the world and the businesses and the non-governmental organizations to start to really take it seriously and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And as I say, we are not moving in this direction as a way to from a position of anger or from victimhood. It is really very much from a position of strength. And we're hoping that the purpose of the petition, actually our purpose of the petition, is to educate and to encourage the government of the United States to join the community of nations in this global campaign to combat climate change. And that's what I mean by the Arctic can be that bridge. And that's what we're very hopeful about. And so what are our rights that are specified in the 1948 Declaration that are being violated? Well, the petition specifies the right to life and physical security, the right to personal property, the right to health, the right to practice our culture, the right to use our to use land traditionally used and occupied, and the right to the means of subsistence. And I just want to be able to show you that even though it's not what we call a legal lawsuit, it is still a remarkable piece of legal work. And this is the actual petition itself. And we worked with Earth Justice in San Francisco. We worked with the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington, D.C. We worked with two American students, one from Harvard and one from Dartmouth, who actually, the two students, went up into the communities and videotaped the testimonies of our elders and our hunters and our women that we incorporated into the petition. This is a thick document that weaves the observations of our hunters and elders and women to these rights that I just spoke to you about. And it is a remarkable piece of work. We put a lot of heart and soul into this, but we put a lot of very strong, it's the full package, I would say, of the intellect and the heart and soul of what needs to get addressed. And in fact, for those of the lawyers in the room, there's over 700 footnotes in this, so you can appreciate the kind of work that went into this. And because absolute reductions are absolutely necessary and a requirement for us to be able to save our hunting culture in the Arctic. And this is not going to happen unless the United States joins the community of nations to combat the issue. That's the bottom line. And what is the relief that we're seeking from the Commission? Well, we're asking for, in addition to the declaration that I spoke about earlier, we've asked the Commission to recommend that the United States, number one, it's very reasonable what we're asking for, one, adopt mandatory measures to limit its emissions of greenhouse gases in cooperation with the community of nations. Two, take into account the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on the Arctic and Inuit before approving all major government actions. Three, in consultation with Inuit, develop a plan to protect Inuit culture and the Arctic environment and mitigate any harm caused by U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And in cooperation with Inuit, develop a plan to help Inuit adapt to unavoidable climate change impacts. They're reasonable and very responsible suggestions. And they are the sort of things that government of any and every political stripe should be doing anyway to protect and help their citizens and to promote sustainable development in the world, because that's that balance that we're trying to find after all, right? And it's that whole issue of sustainability and the balance that we're seeking. So I want to talk just a few minutes about the actual spirit that motivates and guides this petition that we worked on. And as I say, this is not an angry piece of work. This is not sourced from anger. It's not aggressive and it's not confrontational. And I think I've disappointed some people by saying that, because I think media who have depicted this sometimes as the David and Goliath story, because it sells and so on and so forth, it's good for newspapers to be writing in those terms. That's not how we ourselves have been seeing this, and certainly with my leadership, I have not felt it to be that way, that I was going up against some giant and feeling this kind of powerlessness over the matter. We've come into it from a position of strength, from a position of clarity. And of course, this is a very strong political and media strategy. There's no doubt about it, but it's also a very strong piece of work that really tells it like it is in terms of using the instruments that are there to help us. It is very powerful. It is a very assertive legal defense of our human rights, even though it's not a lawsuit.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to Sheila Watt-Cloutier, Inuit activist, on The Right to Be Cold, Climate Change, and Human Rights.
And as I said, we're not seeking damages and so on. You know, and as I said, this petition has been set up. This kind of petition is set up by governments in the Americas that we have petitioned this commission. That is, this particular commission, like some others, have been set up for that kind of protection of human rights, which we all share. And it's not even our intent, as the media often has tried to depict it as, they're just trying, it's not really a strong legal stance. They're just trying to embarrass the United States government into taking action. In fact, that hasn't even been our issue, to try to embarrass anyone, but to bring people on board. It's a means of inviting the United States to come and talk to us and deal with this issue of this global issue in human terms. And where it belongs in terms of human rights terms. And our intent is, of course, to encourage and to inform the world what is happening. And, you know, because we know that in democracies like here and Canada and many, many places in the world, public opinion usually becomes public policy. And so we have been working and speaking and trying to get people to understand that it's our changes and our understandings and our attitudes. Once we start to change them, then we can start to change the world as we become a global community that is singing from the same song sheet. And I think it is through that kind of common ground of making this a human issue that we can really start to move those mountains, so to speak. And so it is our aim to change the hearts and the minds of the citizens of not only the United States, but certainly policymakers as well, as we speak to people. And I can tell you that I work with a lot of Americans. I work with Kyoto USA and many mayors around. We had, in fact, last spring, Tom and Jane Kelly from Berkeley came to the Arctic, where we did an aerial art piece, you know, using John Quigley from Los Angeles, who's an aerial artist who uses people to create messages. And we were about 800 community members on the ice, 25 below. And here we were, we made an image of a drum dancer with Arctic warning on it. And of course the helicopter comes up and then takes the pictures. Now any one of you can look up on Google it, and you'll see, if you look up arcticwisdom.org, you'll see that image. And we were able to bring people and invite people up. We had Selma Hayek and we had Jake Gyllenhaal come up last spring and just do that kind of media work with us. It was just amazing. And we work with many. And I have had, since the launching of our petition, in fact, I have had more emails and communications from the citizens of the United States to come and invite me to speak and to work together, and what could they do to help to get this moving forward. So that's what this is all about, and I think we really need to continue to be reaching out. Now again, when I talk about the petition, for us, as I say, it's not an aggressive act, but what it is in what we have seen and the work that we do, and of course with the hunters, it's a gift. It's an act of generosity, in fact, from our hunters and our elders and our women to be giving this early warning to the rest of the world. As I say, it's late for us in many ways. Not too late, but we can see that it's late for us in the Arctic, but it is still early in many ways for a lot of people around the world. And so it is an act of generosity from an ancient culture that is still deeply tied to our natural environment and still in tune with its wisdom to an urban, industrial, more modern world that sometimes can be lost in its sense of connection to nature and what is happening. And I often say that it is because of that disconnect that is happening around the world that we are debating this issue of climate change in the first place. It is the disconnect between ourselves and our neighbors, between ourselves and the environment, that we are debating this in the first place. Because you know, when I go around the world and we see that there is just no connection to what is it that we do in our homes, what is it we do in our communities and cities far away from what is happening in the Arctic, that I realize that it is so important for us to continue to start really thinking in terms of connectivity and the interconnectedness of all of us in this world. And so the disconnects are just everywhere. There are layers and layers of it. And if we can use the Arctic as a place that connects us as to what's happening up there, I think it's very important. Isn't that a wonderful picture? And he's not cold. He's happy to be out there. So we know, you know, these things that are happening. I'm very hopeful. I'm an optimist to begin with in terms of what the world can come to come to that common ground. When I worked very hard in for several years on the persistent organic pollutants issue and really just went around the world wherever the negotiations were happening at the UN level, and at the end of the day we were able to be part of the Stockholm Convention being signed. The Stockholm Convention is what is now eliminating these persistent organic pollutants at their source, and as we speak, they're being shut off at their source. These are the pollutants that end up in the Arctic sink, in the marine mammals that we eat, and then in our bodies and the nursing milk of our mothers. I know that the world is quite capable of doing the right thing. We have that experience with the POPs issue. I know that climate change is much harder and tougher because we've got an incredible country like the United States that is not signing on and is often the odd man out when it comes to the global negotiations. So we've got our work cut out for us. But every time I come out to speak, I was invited by Bill Clinton to the Clinton Global Initiative back in September in New York City, and met so many people there, Republicans, Democrats alike, and people who don't qualify themselves as either, who just wanted to do something about all of these issues that the world is grappling with, including the issue of climate change. And they would very much like to have, want the U.S. to reclaim some of that incredible goodwill and international leadership that your nation once had. And everywhere I go, that language, I hear it all the time. And I heard, and I know I met Hillary Clinton when she was there, she and John McCain. I testified at Senator John McCain's Senate hearing on climate change a year and a half ago, and that is also on our website if you ever wanted to read that. And, you know, there are people in this country, no matter what political party you're from, are really just trying very hard to make a difference. And so it really gives me that hope that we are getting somewhere in terms of a global community, in terms of the citizens of America, because as I say, there are so many citizens of America that are way ahead of their own government, and I get to see that everywhere I go now, not only in the United States, but when I'm at different forums and I see John, Tom, and Jane Kelly working so hard at the COP11 in Montreal to make sure that they're pushing the U.S. delegation to do the right thing. And if you ever want to talk about or learn more about what they're doing, of course, you can Google that too, and it's all there. They're just remarkable people. They had the city of Berkeley sign on to that over a year ago when they were up in the Arctic in the springtime, when they were up to doing our Arctic Wisdom event. And when I saw them again in Montreal in December, they were up to like 189 cities that had been the mayors that had signed on. So there's a momentum happening here in this country. I also heard too, when I was in New York last fall, and heard General Wesley Clark talk about the need to reclassify this issue of climate change from an environmental issue to one of national security. And then maybe that would be addressed more rapidly than it is now. So that's a good idea for some people to start to push. So of course, there are important connections between the melting Arctic and the impacts far away from our homelands. And again, I talk about the Greenland ice sheet will eventually cause 7 meters of global sea rise. Imagine this. And we know that low-lying regions like the coastal Florida, and in fact Louisiana, not to mention the low-lying developing states in the small island developing states in the Pacific, are all sinking as the Arctic melts. And you can't get, even just physically or geographically, you know, in terms of the physical science, you can't get any more clear than that in terms of understanding connectivity. As Greenland ice, which is basically an ice sheet, by the way, as it's melting, the others are sinking. We're one planet here. And you can't get clearer than that in terms of understanding connectivity. And also, as Greenland is melting, the ice cap is melting, and it's, as I said earlier, is melting much quicker than previously predicted. It has a major impact on the ocean circulation. And so the southern oceans are already much warmer. And as a result of that, they're storing a lot more energy. And so we've seen the devastating consequences of that violent release of that added energy when it comes to Katrina and Rita. And those are the connections now that people are starting to make, that it's not just a faraway Arctic issue. This is about everybody. And it's about all of us. And as I say, I remain very optimistic about all of these things. And I know that things are going to move ahead. Now, again, I just want to start to end here, because I think we're we're getting on here. I come from a small community, as I said, you know, and I said this to you a little bit earlier, that I traveled only by dog team the first 10 years of my life, and that many Americans in my history played a very key role. And as I said, during that Second World War, played a very important role. And I think, you know, we have felt this, and even after 9/11 in the Arctic in Nunavut and Nunavik. Nunavik is where I was born. Nunavut is where I'm living now. There are, after 9/11, the airwaves didn't stop on the radio for 2 full weeks, just with our sense of connection and compassion to what had happened here. Because we have that history that is so strong and so powerful, where you came at a time, your countrymen, your military came at a time when we needed your help so very much. And I think we often say this, and I said this at the Senate testimony, come back to help. We need your help. And this is a time when we need America the most to be able to deal with all of these issues, because you're a powerful nation that has it in it to be able to lead. And without your leadership, the globe is not going to come together to be able to put this issue forward. It really isn't. And that's why we make this such an important issue. It's about, you know, for us, yes, right now, we're the first being impacted negatively, disproportionately in the Arctic. That's what this is all about for, yes, it's all about that in the future of our children. But again, as I say, it's about all of us. And we once again need the America of the United States of America. We need to come together at this time in history so that we can feel that sense of connection, because I think it's once we feel that sense of connection, that common ground is what's going to help us to start to think about what we do in our daily lives, that what you do down here in the United States or in Russia, in Mexico, and different places where greenhouse gases are spewing out all over the place and ending up in the Arctic, everywhere else in the Arctic, and making this planet so warm that even an entire way of life of an entire peoples is now perhaps going to end by my grandson's lifetime. This is my grandson. He's almost 9. And as I say, this is the little boy that drives the work that I do. I'm a mother and grandmother. You know, really just not fearful that it paralyzes me, But it's a fear that propels me to do what I do, because it is the future of these next generations, of this little boy who's growing up in that kind of challenge already that we're faced with in the Arctic. But it's also because all of us need to feel that sense of real responsibility towards the next generations and use the Inuit story, the compelling challenges that we face in the Arctic, to do what we need to do to come together as a global community. And again, come back, America, because we need you. And I thank you for having me here, and thank you, Nikki, for inviting me. Nakomi, thank you.
That was Sheila Watt-Cloutier speaking on the Arctic environment, climate change, and human rights in Missoula, Montana in March 2006. Born in the tiny community of Gujuwag in northern Quebec, Ms. Watt-Cloutier was raised traditionally on the land for 10 years before attending school in Churchill, Manitoba. She currently makes her home in Iqaluit in Nunavut. In her capacity as president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference from 1995 to 2002, and her election as international chair in 2002, she was successful in persuading states to sign a global agreement to ban the generation and use of persistent organic pollutants, such as DDT and the PCBs that contaminate the Arctic food chain. Most recently, her work has emphasized the human face of the impacts of global climate change in the Arctic. In addition to maintaining an active speaking and media outreach schedule, she, with the ICC, has launched the world's first international legal action on climate change. In December of 2005, the ICC petitioned the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, seeking a declaration that unchecked emissions of greenhouse gases have violated Inuit cultural and environmental human rights, as guaranteed by the 1948 American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man. Although the suit was rejected at first, the Commission held a hearing on the issue on March 1, 2007. An audio recording of the hearing is available at CIDH.org. For more information on Sheila Watt-Cloutier and her work, visit InuitCircumpolar.com. This has been Canadian Voices, a national public affairs radio series produced by Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. This March 2006 lecture was sponsored by the Wilderness Institute at the University of Montana and recorded by Montana Public Radio, KUFM. Other lectures from this Wilderness series are available at wilderness.net, a program of the Wilderness Institute. We would like to thank the project supporters for their volunteer and financial assistance, and the campus and community radio stations across Canada for airing the series. For more information and resources on the content of this lecture, as well as an archive of all Canadian Voices programs, please visit our website at canadianvoices.org. The site also contains information on podcasting and how you can financially contribute to the project's ongoing success. Theme music is an arrangement by Blox recording artist Final Fantasy, reinterpreted by the Nelson BC duo Overlap. Canadian Voices has been coordinated by Zoe Creighton, with input from volunteers across the country. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. This is the Local Brown Bagger program. From their album Valentino, this is the all-Canadian band Weeping Tile with their song Basement Apartment.
Thank you. God, I